Good morning, everyone. The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will now come to order. Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Plakin?
Here.
Vice Chair Fernandez-Barquin?
Here.
Representatives Barnaby? Beltran?
Here.
Benjamin?
Here.
Byrd?
Here.
Caruso?
Here.
Davis?
Here.
Fabricio?
Here.
Ranking Member Gottlieb?
Here.
Gregory? Coster?
Here.
Learned?
Here.
Rayner? Smith?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With the quorum being present, I want to welcome everybody this morning to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure all cell phones are silent or off. And if anybody would like to speak before the committee, please make sure to see staff to fill out an appearance card. Today, we're going to hear from the remaining departments within our jurisdiction regarding the budget priorities as requested for the 2022-23 legislative budget request. And as usual, I want to encourage questions and input for the, you know, these recommendations, and they'll be here, I'm sure, to answer questions both now and after the meeting. So we'll go ahead and get started. Our first presentation will be from the Department of Corrections, and presenting will be Chief Financial Officer Mark Talent. Welcome, you are recognized.
Secretary Inch, I'd like to thank you. Is that on? Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present the department's fiscal year 22-23 legislative budget priorities. The department focused on four strategic objectives in developing our fiscal year 22-23 LBR: reducing staff attrition and vacancy rates, reducing inmate violence, addiction, and idleness, maximizing efficient and effective custody and care operations, mission support, and infrastructure requirements. With these objectives in mind, our top agency priority is for $5 million to fund a comprehensive prison modernization and staffing structure analysis. This will be a multidisciplinary effort conducted by an outside firm. The study would define the economic and demographic trends and conditions in Florida over the next several decades and make comprehensive recommendations as to the most efficient and cost-effective approach to re-engineer the department to meet the corrections challenges that will come with those trends and conditions. Additionally, with this requested study is the modernization of hospital services currently provided by the Reception and Medical Center Hospital. The scope of the study would be to seek to provide a cost-benefit analysis on replacing or converting portions of our current hospital and surrounding buildings to provide more efficient and effective delivery of healthcare services and ancillary services. Another top agency priority is a request for $171.1 million to provide funding to implement a comprehensive pay plan that brings the baseline salary for our certified staff to $20 an hour. This would include Correctional Officer Series, Correctional Probation Officer Series, and Inspector General Series. This plan adjusts salaries to account for pay compression and removes disincentives and promotion to external job opportunities. The department is facing unsustainable staff attrition and anemic recruitment. This has resulted in nearly 5,500 vacancies among security staff. During the last 3 months, the department has lost 1,393 Correctional Officer Series employees and gained just 728. The department's current starting base rate of pay is $16 an hour and ranks 51st against Florida County jails. If the pay plan is funded, the base rate of pay increases to $20 an hour, and the ranking would jump to 23rd against county jails. I cannot emphasize enough how important the request for comprehensive pay plan is. As you all know, staffing is our biggest challenge, and this request is designed specifically to help in this area. The department is also requesting $15.8 million to address retention and of experienced officers. The priority impacts correctional officers, correctional probation officers, and Inspector General Series positions. Raising the base rate pay is necessary to address the ongoing and severe shortage of correctional officers and correctional probation officers. But retaining these experienced officers long-term will also be required to safely operate our facilities. The department requests funding for a targeted retention pay step plan to provide $2,500 retention increase for officers and inspectors reaching 8 years of service, $1,500 retention increase for those reaching 5 years, and a $1,000 retention increase for those reaching 2 years. Using targeted pay increases to incentivize retention is a critical component of the department's ongoing plan to address staffing. The department requests $7.2 million to convert correctional probation supervisors, correctional probation senior supervisors, correctional officer lieutenants, and correctional officer captains that are currently classified as career service to select exempt status. They have significant independent managerial functions, which classifies them as select exempt service positions, given the breadth of managerial control, responsibility, and independent oversight each of these positions cover. The conversions of these positions to SES allows the department to hire and retain more qualified captains, lieutenants, senior supervisors, and supervisors. The conversion will also expand the department's managerial base and allow for the proper compensation and retention of these critical leaders. The department requests the authority to reassign 435 existing vacancies and the funding associated with these vacancies to convert the remainder of the department's institutions to an 8.5-hour shift schedule. The 435 FTEs would be reassigned from 29 dorms that have been closed due to staffing. The additional half-hour shift will allow for shift briefings and travel time to and from post. Again, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to finalize the transition of 8.5-hour shifts to the remaining 16 institutions. The department requests $27.5 million in trust fund authority to the student. Funds will increase educational programming and substance use treatment, improve inmate health and well-being, decrease inmate idleness and violence, and provide opportunities for rehabilitation and restoration of inmates prior to release. This issue includes $7.5 million in fixed capital outlay, major repairs, renovations, and improvements to facilities to provide trust fund authority for the renovation of inmate wellness and program space statewide. Under current language, FTC's authority is capped at $2.5 million. The department requests $15.1 million for offender-based information system. That would be our OBIS modernization. The department proposes a 5-year plan to modernize OBIS. Currently, FTC is maintaining a 40-year-old legacy mainframe system that serves as a primary data repository for inmate management, classification, work assignments, disciplinary information, custody status, and until recently, health grades. Designed in 1981, this system operates on severely outdated technology that requires a sinking resource pool of specific skills to maintain mission-critical operations. However, due to its extensive use, OBIS is indispensable to the operational performance of the department. The department requests $1.9 million to fund 12 Office of Human Resources FTE. These additional positions address statewide recruitment efforts and fill critical correctional officer vacancies. This request will allow human resource manager to be hired for each of the department's 4 regions to direct regional recruitment and report directly to regional office leadership. Each region will also receive 2 human resource specialists to provide oversight to drive recruitment efforts to focus on quality, timely, and comprehensive hiring processes at the local level. The department requests $2.2 million to develop a statewide plan to provide all certified firearm-carrying correctional probation officers with a department-issued weapon, holster, and other required equipment. Providing CPOs with necessary field safety equipment will reduce operational inefficiencies, training inconsistencies, and officer safety issues and state liability. Presently, CPOs are not required to carry a firearm, and current procedures allow for voluntary firearm certification. If staff choose to carry a firearm on duty, they are required to purchase their own firearm and bear the total cost of maintaining it. This includes the weapon, the holster, and the duty belt. The department requests $5 million to purchase required security equipment that leverages advanced technology and improves public safety and the efficiency of operations. Some examples include surveillance camera systems, metal detectors, electronic key issue systems, biometric identification systems, warehouse pallet scanners, mattress scanners, special teams equipment, grounds maintenance equipment, and motion lights. The department requests $2.5 million and 33 FTE to add additional death row correctional officer positions to the security roster in response to litigation. One of the main complaints of the litigation is inmates on death row are not offered more out-of-cell time compared to inmates not sentenced to death. In January 2020, the department initiated a pilot at Union Correctional Institution, which houses the majority of Florida's death row inmates. The department converted one cell on one wing to a day room for congregate activities. These also provided the ability to increase inmate phone privileges, access to multimedia kiosks, showers, and job assignments. Adding death row movement correctional officer positions to the security roster will improve the department's ability to manage a high-profile population and ensure compliance with litigation requests for inmate out-of-cell time. The department requests $1.1 million to fund 14 additional FTE for the addition of a correctional officer sergeant position to the security rosters at facilities. This is year two of a three-year plan. The rise of security threat groups, STGs or gangs, has been a component in the increased violence within our correctional institutions. This request funds 14 correctional officer sergeant positions, which allows the department to have one sergeant position at approximately half the institutions, who is dedicated solely to the STG research and analysis. These positions will allow the department to better manage STGs, improve staffing levels, and increase safety and security of institutions. The next issue requests $1.2 million to fund 13 FTEs for the Office of the General Counsel. These additional positions are to address staffing issues due to the increased workload. The Office of the General Counsel has experienced increased workload and complex litigation over the past 10 years. The legal issues presented in this agency are complex and multifaceted. The Department of Corrections has many constitutional mandates, and each institution functions as a small city within its requisite legal issues. There are not enough attorney positions to provide adequate legal coverage for all of the many subject matters presented by an agency this size. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, in an effort to save a little time, I will briefly go through the remaining two slides. The department requests $341,000 to fund four FTEs for professional development, training, and support staffing. The department requests $2 million in recurring funding for the replacement of critical vehicles. We request $1 million to assist with the repairs and maintenance to the department's fleet. The department requests $30.2 million to outsource the department's food service operations, fund three FTEs to provide statewide monitoring of outsourcing food service operations at all facilities, and increase the food per diem. The department requests $1.3 million in funding for 10 FTEs within the health services program for the creation of two additional behavioral risk management teams needed to assess clinical risk and patient safety at high-risk institutions. The next issue requests $1 million in non-recurring funds from general revenue to replace approximately 1,000 of the department's oldest computers. The department requests $5.7 million from general revenue to allow the department to procure a combination of tools and services to address cybersecurity. The department requests $10.1 million to fund 132 FTE to provide the ability to safely conduct recreation and segregation units of prisoners in special management housing. The next request is $3.7 million in expense funding for critical repairs and maintenance to our fiscal plants. The department requests $1.2 million in authority in the Sales of Goods and Services Trust Fund to perform repairs and renovations to the staff housing units at facilities statewide. The department requests $8.4 million in general revenue for contracted comprehensive health care to cover the annualized impact of the increased cost for staffing, hospitalization, and related physician fees due to the new healthcare marketplace. The department requests $14 million to provide price level increases or increased per diem amounts for contract rebeds at privately operated correctional institutions. We request $382,000 in authority in the Grants and Donations Trust Fund for payment of repairs and facility infrastructure. The department is requesting a total of $41.1 million in funding for fixed capital outlay to address major repairs and renovations, security enhancements, ADA compliance issues, and department facilities statewide. And lastly, the department is requesting $158.2 million in authority in the Grants and Donations Trust Fund for the construction of a 550-bed inpatient mental health hospital at Lake Correctional Institution. This authority is needed for the department to expend bond proceeds from the Series 2021A Certificate of Participation Series, which was authorized as part of Senate Bill 2500. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This concludes my presentation.
Well, thank you for being here this morning and outlining the priorities. Vice Chair Fernandez-Barquin, you are recognized.
Hey, how are you, sir? Thank you so much for coming. My question deals with the compensation. Is the requested increase for compensation, does that also take into account an increase in compensation for the CEOs in the private institutions or just or exclusively just of public institutions?
Our pay plan. Our pay plan is solely for department certified staff. It does not include the private prisons.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabricio, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, sir, for coming and speaking with us and presenting. Over the interim, I had an opportunity to visit Everglades Correctional Institution, toured the facility, and I saw that there was a stark need for additional staff. Absolutely. I'd like to sit down with you at some point and kind of drill down into the numbers to make sure to see where the $171 million is going to go and to make sure that it's properly staffing our jails in the state. But it is a critical need. Thank you so much.
Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, sir, for your presentation. Lots of numbers. I'm a CPA, and it's a lot of numbers. And what you got here is about $530 million, but that's not your whole budget. These are is it your whole budget?
You recognize,
Chair? It's an 18.57% increase over our base budget of about $2.8 billion.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You recognize?
Thank you, sir. I'm just wondering, numbers are always relative in my mind, and I'm wondering if we could get a presentation like this, but with last year's numbers next to it, and then this year's request, and then the percentage increase to the side of it, I think it would help us in our analysis of the budget request. Sure. Thank you.
Yes, that can be provided.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, Ranking Member Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Talent, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I've spoken in the past with Mr. Torres, who's present today, and Secretary Inch, and I have nothing but respect for the department and the mission that you guys are trying to accomplish. But I'd really like to know if you're able to tell us the attrition and vacancies that you're talking about, is that a product of moving from 12 hours to 8 hours? Because now we're here and we want to move to 8.5 hours, or is it a product of COVID? Or, you know, it just seems terrible. You're saying that you've lost, I think, 1,600 or 1,700 employees and only been able to hire 700 back. What's the problem and what's the solution?
You recognize?
Thank you. I think it's a combination of many things. I think pay is one. You know, currently we're competing with the service industry. We're competing with big box retailers, distribution centers. So we think the pay plan increasing to reflect the risk involved with the job is an important step. Since we've converted to 8.5 hour shifts, actually we've seen improvement. Our unmanned critical post during our phase one implementation of 8.5 hour shifts decreased from roughly 18,000 to a little over 3,000. So that's a significant improvement. In phase two implementation of 8.5 hour shifts, our unmanned post from 16,600 down to about 2,500. So we think the 8.5 hour shift is another critical step. Retention is something that we have a problem with. Our recruiting, we recruit 3,000 to 4,000 officers a year. It's retention. They're walking out the door. If there's targeted retention where they see a step plan in the future, we think that will help keep them. So I think it's really multifaceted. I think as the attrition has increased and overtime has increased, I think they're getting tired. mean, we're wearing officers out, so I think that has a lot to it. It's a very high-stress job, and working a lot of hours under these conditions puts a lot of stress on everybody. So I think compensation is very important.
You recognize for a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. I agree with that, and I question whether or not your targeted retention numbers are even adequate to keep officers there. I mean, $1,000 for somebody who's been working that same job for 2 years seems low. You know, so if they don't like the job and it's dangerous and the hours are oppressive, is $1,000 really enough to keep somebody there? And the reason I picked 2 years is that person, you've spent the time, energy in training that person, and they're relatively new in the job. Should we be looking at more money? Is it feasible?
You recognize?
That's a good question. And, you know, is it enough? But I think in combination with the pay package, because the pay package, we're taking a 33,500 job and we're taking it to 41,600. That's a very significant increase. And then we address compression throughout the ranks. So as these officers stay and promote up, there's some significant jumps in pay as the responsibilities jump. So I think the combination of the two, I think, is a good starting point. Is it adequate? It may be something that needs to be readdressed in the future, but we do think it's a good starting point.
Recognized for a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. My last question. I thought when you outlined your four priorities, you indicated that one of them was reducing addiction. Is that correct? Is that what I heard?
You recognize?
And if so, I missed what you said about it, if I heard that correctly.
Sorry. Let me find them. Don't have them memorized. We have staff attrition and vacancy rates, and then in the programming side to help reduce inmate violence, addiction, and idleness, so the substance use. So,
can you tell us what is the department's plan and how much money you're looking for to do that?
We currently have funding for both in-prison and community substance abuse. We're asking for the Inmate Welfare Trust Fund to increase the authority from $2.5 million to $27.5 million. $7.5 million would go to the fixed capital outlay to improve program space to allow us to kind of expand our programs. And $20 million would go to, you know, vocational training, academic training, more substance abuse training.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Learned, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the testimony. I completely agree with all my colleagues as the need in our prisons. I think all of us that have visited see it. So thank you for responding with the request. I have two questions. This is the first I heard about the move to a privatized food service provider. I was hoping you could shed a little bit more detail on that as far as the cost savings versus what we expect as far as service delivery and if there's any issues on that front.
You recognize?
The food service operations really deals with staffing. Currently, the department has 284 FTE assigned to our food service operations. 58% of those are vacant. Another main component of ours is OPS. We actually have 376 OPS positions in our food service operations. 253 of those are vacant. Every time we have a vacant position in the food service operation, somebody needs to be in there to supervise the inmate. So we have to take a correctional officer off post, move them to the kitchen. So now we're short officers on the post. Another thing is, I don't know that it's necessarily a savings, unless you count the amount of hours we're having to use correctional officers to supplement the staffing. If we go to a private provider, they will provide all the staffing. The food costs will remain the same. And then part of this is increasing the quality of the food, you know, given some better choices, some additional choices. Overall, we would take the $30 million, it's really about a $50 million increase, but about $25 million would be funded by us as we give up the FTE and we give up the OPS. To make it work on the state side, we would probably have to convert all the OPS to career service, because currently we're not even competing with the fast food chains with what we pay. I mean, minimum wage has, the $13 has brought them up significantly. But I think like McDonald's and places like that are now at the $15 rate. So we're not even competing with the staffing. So it's kind of a combination of quite a few things.
You recognize for a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. That's interesting. So I appreciate it. I also want to ask about the money that we generate in our canteens and our phone calls and the letters and all that stuff. Where does that money go? Is that in any of these budgets?
Currently, everything generated in the canteen, phone commissions, various things like that, goes to general revenue. The department is allowed to retain $2.5 million to fund inmate welfare trust fund operations. We average between $35 and $40 million a year, but those funds do go to general revenue. That's why we're requesting to expand the inmate welfare trust fund to $27.5 million. So we're trying to keep more of the funds in our budget to provide inmate programming.
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure I understand that correctly. So we're generating $35 to $40 million off of our inmates currently. One of your top priorities was reducing inmate idleness. Right. One of the things we're generating revenue on, as far as I understand, is we sell them the iPads that they're allowed to have in the dorms. Is there any thought as to buying more of our inmates iPads so they can do some of this educational program, reduce idleness at a zero expense to taxpayers?
You're recognized.
For sure. I am going to have to get back with you on that one. There's nothing I know of about providing additional. We do provide indigent inmates who can't afford them access to these devices. We are looking to increasing the programming available on these tablets to help. But on the other question, I'll have to get back with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. And just a quick question, and I know you've heard it from here. We all understand the staffing issues and the significantly high turnover, and I don't think anybody would disagree that a dish help with that. And what you've asked for is certainly a significant increase and probably well-deserved because of the nature of the duty. However, to the 8.5-hour shift, I can tell you from my visits to the Central Receiving Facility in Central Florida and a recent visit to Moca, the only people that I've ever heard express support or enthusiasm for the shift change is DOC leadership. Because just from corrections officers to others, most people just roll their eyes and think that's one of the issues that is contributing to your people leaving is the change in this move to the 8.5-hour shift. Because I don't think, and probably highly unlikely, I'm certainly not an expert, but I don't think the members of this committee fully understand exactly the shift change and the impacts that are having on your workforce. Because I can just tell you from the corrections officers I've spoken to, nobody outside of DOC leadership wants it. So as you mentioned earlier, you might readdress issues. I honestly and seriously think you should relook at that on the potential impact it's having for the vacancy rate that you do have. I'm not sure there's a question in there, but I would ask you to please reconsider that.
Yes, sir.
Would you consider reconsidering it, I think is what you're asking.
With the 8.5-hour shift, I've worked for the agency my entire career, so I've been there a long time. I were there when we were at the 8.5-hour shift. I was there during the conversion to the 12-hour shift, and now I'm working through the conversion back to the 8.5-hour shift. When we were 8.5 or 8-hour shift facilities, you know, many years ago, our vacancy rate never really exceeded 5 or 6%. When we converted to the 12-hour shift, we lost hundreds of positions because you don't need as many to do 12-hour shifts as you do 8.5-hour shifts. But the vacancy rate has steadily increased, and the overtime has steadily increased. And one thing to I think is important is a lot of the officers we have today were not around when we had 8.5-hour shift, so they do not know what it's like to work an 8.5-hour shift and be able to go home to your family And, you know, I think the biggest complaint is probably with a 12-hour shift, you get every other weekend off. 8.5-hour shift, it's kind of a little more structured and scheduled. So I think a lot of the staff just haven't worked the 8.5-hour shift to understand the work-life balance it gives you. But I will certainly take your concerns back to agency leadership.
You recognize?
Thank you, Chair.
Fabricio.
Quick question. With regard to retention, employee pay and retention, it's my understanding that from speaking to some of the wardens and other corrections officers, at least in South Florida, that part of the problem had to do with the fact that the pay scale that being provided by the Department of Corrections is not commensurate to what the county jails were paying. So this increase that we're looking at here, $171 million, will that put this pay scale for DOC in alignment with what county corrections is paying?
You recognize?
Currently, our $16 an hour, our $33,500 ranks us 51st if we were a county. So out of 67 counties, we would be 51st. Going to the $20 an hour starting pay, that moves us up to 23rd, so kind of the bottom of the top third. Above us in that ranking, if the pay plan were approved, are about five counties with institutions. So we think we become very competitive with most of the state, yes.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Fernandez-Barquin, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teller, my question, I want to echo what Representative David Smith said, because I've had the same conversation with several COs, and let's assume that there is no double shift, right, for a CO. What is the typical structure of the amount of days on and off for these individuals, for these COs?
You recognize?
Not being an expert in the shifts and everything like that, I'll have to get that information for you. I want to make sure I provide it accurately, and I just don't think I can talk it off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Teller. And also, I have another question, Mr. Chair. Are you all conducting exit interviews to see where exactly these individuals are going? You mentioned retail stores and things like that, but are they also going to other law enforcement agencies?
You recognize?
Mr. Chair. Yes, sir. We do lose staff to other agencies, and yes, we do conduct exit survey data. Recently, I provided it to Mr. Keith, our survey-type questions, so your committee does have access to some of the data we have, but yes, we do lose officers to county jails. Absolutely.
You recognize?
And Mr. Teller, do you know if these other agencies are operating on 8-hour shifts or 12-hour shifts by any chance?
Personally, I do not know that answer.
Okay.
But we can find out.
All right. I have another question. And one last question in reference to the increase in pay for the public institutions. Is there a concern in creating a disparity between the public institutions and the private institutions? Is there any concern on your part, you know, possibly on creating essentially an exodus of the CEOs in the private institutions to go to the public, and any concern on your end on that?
You recognize?
We certainly don't want that to happen. Generally, the private prisons have come to the legislature and gotten price level increases that have included staff salaries. So, you know, is there a fear of that? You know, there's always a fear. You know, we don't want to get into a bidding war with private prisons or county jails. We just want to, you know, keep our staff.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have one, I guess, comment sort of question on the shift changes. I think you said you were here for the last shift change. And I'd spent a lot of time looking into this last year, because obviously it's a controversial issue. And this is my opinion, but I came to the conclusion of a lot of it is just people don't like change. And some of the opponents of this I met with last year that were here, and I said, wasn't it like that when we shifted the other way? And they reluctantly agreed that it was. And then things settled in, and, you know, to the to the status quo. So my opinion is that a big amount of this is people don't like change. And I get that. I think that's that way in business, and I presume it's the same way in corrections. So would you agree with that? Would be my question.
I would absolutely agree with that. When we converted from 8.5 to 12, there was a lot of pushback at that time also.
Right. Okay. My other question is, as you know, last year, this committee, we wrote into the budget language regarding the option to close facilities. Can you just give us an update on that proviso and any efforts the department's made or ideas that you've had, and just basically an update on that?
The department is currently, we're weighing all our options. We are certainly evaluating the proviso. We have till December 31st to submit our plan. It is certainly something on our radar and something we're looking at. Yes, sir.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, Representative Learned.
Sorry, and thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up. So, if we approve these pay increases, when would the average officer expect to see their pay increase?
You recognize?
If the pay plan's approved by the legislature, the governor signs the budget, and it goes into effect July 1st, it would be whatever date the legislature determines implementation. If it's July 1st, July 1st.
We recognize for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anything, last time we heard a presentation from the department in a different committee, I believe, we were being told that the system was in crisis today. And in the last 9 months since the presentation leading up to the 2021 session, that the number of prisons that are in staffing crisis has increased from like 30% to 70%. These are rough numbers, but is there anything we can do between now and July 1st? Because theoretically, we're still on track to be even in a worse position before we get there. So is there anything that can be done between now and then?
You recognize?
I think that is part of the analysis the department is going through in regards to the proviso. The proviso does give us an option to shift some savings to officer salary, and that is certainly what we're evaluating now, which would take place prior to July 1st.
Okay, Representative Davis, you recognize for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to go back into the slide presentation really quickly, and on slide 3, I was just curious, like my colleague said, a lot of numbers in this presentation, but for the prison modernization and alignment analysis, you have a price tag of $5 million to that. The question with that is, who will be conducting that analysis? Is that something a company you've already identified? Is that an RFP? Who will be doing that?
You recognize?
The Department of Management Services has agencies available for the department to contract with. There's been no selection at this point. It would be some type of procurement method. We haven't decided yet to select the best agency or the best firm to do this study.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that. In your presentation, we've all heard about the retention, but you suggested that a step plan in the future would be something that you could possibly use to retain some of your staff. Could you talk a little bit about the step plan? That's the first part of it. And is there nothing when someone is hired that they are mandated to give you so many years, so much time? We're hearing in every committee about staff shortages in our healthcare and our education. And so I'm just thinking out loud, is there something that you all are not doing as far as we are hiring and you are mandated or contracted to be with us for 2 or 3 years to kind of stabilize your staffing and employment situation?
Recognize.
The way the retention plan is set up, basically at a 2-year period, you would get an additional $1,000. It's not a bonus. It would be increased to your recurring pay. At 5 years, you get $1,500. And then at 8 years, you get $2,500. and it's all increases to pay. In regards to the second question, when we provide training and everything like that to our officer and they leave within a certain period of time, I believe it's a year, they are supposed to reimburse the cost of that training. It's not easy to collect because a lot of them leave before wages or anything like that could be garnished. So there is something there. It's just not a very easy collection.
Representative Caruso, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just thought of another question. With all this issues that we're having with retention, you're going to go from, you know, you're proposing to switch to the eight and a half hour workday, and that involves change. We know people don't like change, so we're going to lose people just because we changed. What reasons do you have that you don't make it optional for the employees to be on the 8.5 hour workday or the 12 hour workday?
You recognize?
I think the simple answer to that, and not being a security type person, is scheduling would be a nightmare. Having half your staff at 8.5 hour shifts and half at 12, I think. The scheduling portion of that would just be something that's not obtainable.
Follow-up, Chair.
Recognize.
Wouldn't that just be a function of computers and software?
You recognize.
I don't think the answer is that simple, but our colonels, our shift supervisors, when they reach out to staff and they set the schedules for the week and staff don't show up, then they go down a list to try to fill that post. If you're having 12-hour post and 8.5-hour post, and you need to go down that schedule and fill the post, if the 12-hour person's been there and he worked 4 hours overtime and he's been there 16 hours, you know, he's not available. I think just scheduling would be a nightmare. But I'd be happy to go back to our security staff and see if we can't get you some type of write-up why we don't think that would work.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And I'll just chime in. I spent quite a bit of time last year looking at that very question, and I came to the conclusion the difficulty in coordinating that, because you either have two 12-hours or, I mean, they don't close, you know, after business hours, so it's a 24-hour cycle, so you have 3/8 or two 12s, essentially. So if you start mixing and matching those, it would be difficult for a computer. And I suspect it would lead to uncovered cell blocks, especially when they have shortages. So that's, but I had that very same question last year and explored it. And that's what I came to the conclusion. So, but certainly any information you could provide would be helpful and appreciated. Anyone else? Okay, we have some public testimony today. First of all, Michelle Rothwell. You recognize.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Michelle Rothwell, and I am a voter and a taxpayer of Florida. I vote not in favor for any budget increase. Out of all the increases given in the past years, there were meant for improving the conditions, education, standards of the officers. Nothing has happened. In fact, it's even worse than ever. Not only is it costing taxpayers, but us as loved ones of the incarcerated, we're suffering. As well as our loved ones. There's no air conditioning, limited education, and food that should not even be consumed by humans. Me as a mother of an incarcerated loved one, it is costing me more than ever to supply him with just his basic needs. Our phone calls have doubled and tripled with the new contract between the DOC and Global Telling. For me to even put money on my phone for my son to call me is a $5.95 charge just to add money to my phone to speak to my loved one. Where is that money going, you know? As well as the canteen prices. The FDIC has gotten these increases, and they've always asked for more, and it's just never enough, and no changes have ever been made to the good. To me, what I see from the FDIC is for all these men sleeping on the floors due to the prisons having to overcrowd, closing work camps, is they're having a statewide talent contest. My son got this email, and it says to the department, or the department has authorized the first statewide coordinated competition among inmates. The winner of each institutional competition will compete on a regional level, resulting one regional winner. Each region will declare one winner who will represent and compete with the other regions in a statewide competition. The events are restricted to singing and musical bands. Inmates will notify facilities by staff completing the inmate request and submitting it to the classification department. My son would rather have a great meal and be able to talk to his mother than to worry about competition. Who's going to do that? We're shortage of classification officers now. Who's the judge? I get they may want to do that for morale and whatever, but right now they're in a big crisis, a big, big crisis. Inmates are dying, and it's scary. I'm asking you not to support it. This money is not going where it's supposed to go. It's costing me more. It's costing my family more. We're suffering just to get the basic needs to make sure my son can stay alive and to eat and to be properly taken care of. So I'm asking you, please, don't increase the budget. It's not going where it's supposed to. Thank you.
Okay, next up, Laurette Phillipson. You recognize?
Thank you. Chair, if I may, before I start my presentation, my speech, I would like to answer, if I could, two of the questions that were asked this morning.
You can make those part of your comment.
Thank you. Rep. Leonard, in reference to...
Ma'am, but we're not in questions, so they won't be responding, but you could make comments.
Correct.
Worded
in reference to the tablets. The tablets originally, when they were provided or offered to the incarcerated individuals, they had to be paid for by the family members. Then after, I believe, about 2 years, the tablets were then traded back in, and everybody was entitled to a free tablet. Previous to that, only those that could pay for them got one. Now, the other ones that could not pay for one, they had access to a kiosk. So that's where the tablets are at. When I was incarcerated at Lowell for 8.5 years, and the shift change was taking place from 8 hours to 12, yes, there was a lot of talk among the officers that they were against this shift change. Once the shift change happened, and they saw the amount of overtime they were making, they were on board. I personally know of higher-ranking officers, captains, that gave up their title to go back to being a sergeant so that they could benefit from the overtime. So, yes, there is balk now on not wanting it to go back to 8 hours because of all the money they were making in overtime. So those are my comments there. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Laurette Phillipson, and I'm a voting resident in the state of Florida. As a strong union supporter, I understand the union presidents advocating for additional wages for his membership. I cannot stress enough, the increased pay does not improve behavior. It is about integrity. Integrity is about doing the right thing when no one is looking. I support increased pay with increased education, expansion of yearly training hours, and de-escalation training as well. Part of the education should be in mental health, trauma-informed care, and effective communication skills. I was present at the State Appropriations Subcommittee, Subcriminal and Civil Justice Committee yesterday, October 20th. I listened to the presentation by the Department of Juvenile Justice. Their base paid employee at this time is $13.47 an hour. They're asking for an increase of $17.28 an hour. The third ranking position is a JPO right now at $15.52 an hour. And they must have a college degree. They are requesting their pay raise to $17 an hour. They must have a college degree. They are requesting pay raises from $17 an hour up to $20.94 an hour for different levels of their officers. The pay for a correctional officer today is $16.10 an hour. That is $2.63 more than the Office of the Department of Juvenile Justice. One of the senators questioned yesterday was about their ability to retain staff. The response was they have dedicated staff, and of course, they're interested in ensuring that they hire and retain their staff. Maybe we should be looking at why and how the Department of Juvenile Justice can maintain their staff and not have a situation like the present crisis that FDC is experiencing on these compounds. I am asking the legislators to authorize FDC to release the elderly, sick, and low-level offenders to relieve the pressure FDC is experiencing. If this were done, FDC would not be in the current crisis situation that has now led to the overcrowding and staff shortages. This situation is a result of continued failure to pass any significant criminal justice reform bills. More money is not the solution, but rather looking at ways to reduce the prison population, resulting in reduced staff requirements. I urge you not to support FDC's hourly wage increase until certain provisions, as I stated, are included. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Chris Doolin with the Small County Coalition. You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Doolin. I work with the Small County Coalition. I also represent the small school districts, primarily rural areas. I just wanted to come up and thank you for the work you did last year and the work that went into the proviso language. And in the interim, we've been working with the department, and I have found them very transparent and very direct and very straightforward about the problems. They have a problem, and you guys have recognized it this morning. These institutions are very important to our rural areas. The primary focus that you have is inside the prison, and how do we handle retention and recruitment. The secondary impact is in the community. These institutions have been welcomed in these rural areas, and they're important to the small businesses. They're important to the schools, as far as their families and their kids, and they're important to revenue sharing because the populations account toward census and revenue sharing. So I just want to thank you. I know that you guys are concerned. There may be some hard decisions that have to be made. I would simply ask that if there are closures or consolidation, that there, you know, if there are counties with only one, that those be looked in another direction. If you can stand on the front of a prison and look and see two or three more, we just don't want to see the local community disrupted. And there are probably ways to make that happen. And again, thank you for your time and thank you for what you did last year. It was very much appreciated.
Well, thank you. Next up, James Biardi, representing the Florida State Corrections Chapter of the Florida PBA. You're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you and your staff and Adam for always having a few minutes to see us. I appreciate it, and making sure that the voice of the correctional officers get heard. I think this is one of the greatest committee meetings I've ever been at today. As a matter of fact, when Mr. Town over there used the word step pay plan, I almost ran out of my seat to come up here and hug him. I've heard questions asked about the county jails and why correctional officers leave, and I think that the representatives from Miami hit it right on the nose. The county jails pay more. They have a step pay plan. So when the officers leave to go work there, they have some sort of an idea in a few years from now, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, where their basic salary would be. And it gives them the opportunity to plan and adjust. And let's face it, being a correctional officer is one of the toughest jobs in law enforcement. It is. And in the last 2 years, it's been 10 times harder. For those who don't know, or maybe you're not aware of it, if you ever looked at a CDC form, one of the questions that the CDC asks about COVID is, do you or a member of your immediate family work at a correctional facility? And I see that all the time on the forms. Well, the reason is that the prisons are a big spreader of COVID-19. Officers get sick, they take it home to their families. But you know what they did in the last 2 years? They went to work and they kept it together in tough times. They need some relief. I differ with the department somewhat on some of the methods. I'm glad that we're together, that we need this pay raise for them. I think we have to worry about retention and some of the veteran people. But, you know, we have to act. And no matter what you try to do, and I've sat here and watched for the last couple of years, one plan or another plan or another plan, until we fix the pay problem, we don't know what plan is working or not working because the prisons haven't been properly staffed in years. I look out and I see many people on the committee here that over the last few years, you've heard me say the same thing. Let's fix it once and for all. Let's get the pay fixed. Let's get some retention money. Let's keep our senior people. Yesterday, some of the committee members, I got to visit with some of you. I was bringing some officers around from Lowell CI. I brought one from each rank, an officer, a sergeant, a lieutenant, and captain. At their facility, they are currently 125 officers down, which means in a course of a 40-hour week, they got to cover approximately 5,000, I think it's like 5,200 hours of overtime. That's a huge number. So they go to work pretty much every day knowing that that big number exists. And the cure for it is the pay. I've heard some people saying that they like working overtime, but I can tell you, I get tons of calls every day from correctional officers who tell me, Jimmy, I'm tired. I'm overworked. This ain't good for our environment. They work in a dangerous situation. Every day, there's good inmates and there's bad inmates, but the bad are pretty bad. I'll tell you that. I know firsthand, I've worked in prisons for 30 years. I know what it's like to go in short. And in my 30 years, very rare I went in when the shift was pretty full or had extra people around. It was very rare. I urge you today, tomorrow, to go on and get this matter resolved once and for all. And closing, somebody brought up a good point. I think it was Representative Leonard when he said, is there any plan to do something sooner? I don't think we could wait until July for this crisis. I don't think so. And I'm trying to work with the department to get some eternal money or something to get this going now so we could stop this bleeding. I want to thank everybody for their time. And again, if you just remember one thing I said today, is that no matter what you try to do until you fix this pay issue, until you fix this staffing crisis, nothing's going to work. They're going to be unsuccessful. I'll answer any questions if anybody has any. Thank you very much.
And I would just chime in. I think I can speak for all the members of this committee in saying of our appreciation for the work that the men and women of the Department of Corrections do. We fully realize that this is a very difficult job. I remember I was at Wakulla a few years ago. I've been there a couple times, and there was a handful of legislators, and we walked on a block with one guy with 82 people on the block, and one of the members didn't really want to walk out there, and more than half of them were in for life sentences, not a whole lot to lose. And I understand now that that's not uncommon to see that type of ratio. So we do appreciate the work that they do along with other types of law enforcement. And I know a lot of this is without air conditioning as well.
Yeah.
So regardless of the outcome, and I hope we have a good one that we can get a consensus on, I think we have a great appreciation for the work that the men and women of corrections do. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that'll wrap up Department of Corrections. We're going to move forward to Florida Commission on Offender Review. We'll be recognizing Gina Giacomo presenting on their behalf. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for allowing us to provide our LBR request. I'm speaking on behalf of Chair Coonrod, of Commissioner. The commission is comprised of three commissioners and 132 FTEs in central office and five region offices. Our general revenue is $12,045,599, and our trust fund is $124,160 for a total budget, base budget of $12,170,209. We have five budget requests for you today to consider. Our first request is for $5,174 to increase the daily rate of pay from $100 to $200 per day for temporary commissioners. Former commissioners are authorized by the governor and cabinet as temporary commissioners when they are sitting commissioners on leave or there is a vacancy. Temporary commissioners are vital to ensuring the commission has a quorum to conduct statutory mandated timeframes and legislatively mandated duties. The commission has no discretion in the rate of pay for the temporary commissioners. Florida statute sets the $100 rate of pay for each day or portion of a day that a temporary commissioner works, which equates to less than the state's current minimum wage of $13. Last year, the legislature provided in the GAA a solution for the temporary commissioners to be compensated at minimum wage for fiscal year 21-22, but that will expire July 1st, 2022. If the $100 amount is not changed, the issue of paying temporary commissioners more than $100 a day will again need to be addressed in the GAA for next fiscal year and every year thereafter. As guidance of this request, we look to Section 25073, which provides for retired justices or judges assigned to temporary duty. This statute requires retired judges to be paid not less than $200 each day or a portion of. Temporary judges and commissioners are both responsible for making public safety decisions and should make an equitable pay. The second request we have pertains to litigation expenses is for $130,081 in non-reoccurring funding to the general revenue for litigation expenses. The commission does not receive annual litigation for outside litigation purposes. The commission is involved in a complex civil litigation that may become a class action lawsuit with hundreds of class members. The commission had to obtain outside counsel to litigate the matter because this case could change the criminal sentencing laws of the state of Florida. The Department of Legal Affairs has been retained for the civil rights action that has been filed against the sitting commissioners. If the commission does not receive the funding, it is estimated that three full-time and one part-time OPS commission investigator will need to remain vacant, and they would not be completing clemency investigations. Our third request is for $138,566 in reoccurring funds to increase the base salary of 39 FTE commission investigators to $40,000 and one commission investigation supervisor to $44,306. DMS has not increased the commission investigator base pay of $35,113 for 15 years. Commission investigators conduct quasi-judicial fact-finding revocation hearings, release on your own recognizance hearings, courtesy interstate probable cause hearings. These hearings include issuing subpoenas, receiving testimony under oath from witnesses and victims, determining guilt and whether the violation was willful and substantial, and making recommendations whether to restore supervision or return the offender to prison. In addition, they are responsible for the 8 types of clemency cases, which include capital cases, death row cases. Commission investigators are responsible for conducting comprehensive, confidential clemency investigations while utilizing numerous records in multiple courts, states, federal databases. These investigations are submitted to the governor and cabinet sitting as the executive clemency board. At this time, at the time that we submitted our LBR submission, the commission did not have the DMS $13 adjusted proposed pay grades. The DMS adjusted proposed pay grades for the commission investigator is an additional $84.98 a year per commissioner. The commission will be amending the LBR for fiscal year 22-23 to increase the request to $142,492 to align with the DMS $13 adjusted proposed pay grade. This would have a positive impact if this was funded. If the LBR issue is funded, it will offset the need to keep 4 full-time OPS clemency investigator positions vacant that complete clemency investigations. The commission's 4th request is for $134,584 in reoccurring funds to increase the agency head's salary to $135,000 and the 2 other sitting commissioners to $125,000. The commissioners are appointed by the governor and cabinet and confirmed by the Senate for 6-year terms. Each commissioner handles high-volume caseload at a current salary of $95,506. Annually, commissioners are responsible for over 12,000 decisions regarding offenders. They preside over meetings throughout the state of Florida, making determinations regarding parole, conditional medical release, conditional release, addiction recovery release, issuing warrants, revocations, and making recommendations to the clemency board. As the agency head, the chair has a high volume caseload and has the sole responsibility of the administrative and operational management of the agency. The chairman's salary should reflect those additional responsibilities. This year, the GAA included funding for the governor to adjust agency head salaries. This did not apply to our agency head salary, as their salary is set in Section 8 of the GAA. It is recommended that the chairman's salary be on par with salaries of the public service commissioners, base salary of $135,977, and the commissioner's salary be on par with the salary of an administrative law judge, base salary of $126.762. Our last and 5th budget priority is to transfer $877,910 from the OPS category to the salary and benefits category. The LBR converts OPS clemency commission investigator funding to 14 FTE investigators. The OPS clemency commission investigators perform the same clemency duties as the FTE clemency investigators. They conduct comprehensive, confidential investigations for the governor and cabinet sitting as the clemency board. In the last 2 years, 91% of the OPS commission investigators worked 13 months or less prior to leaving. 36 of the OPS commission investigators either took a reduction in pay to an FTE within our own agency or left the commission for another state agency FTE position. Of our current OPS commission investigators, 56% have been with the commission for 2 years or less. This overturn rate is greatly impacts the quality of staff completing the in-depth clemency cases. Experienced FTEs are consistently and constantly taken away from completing in-depth investigations to train the new ever-revolving OPS Commission investigators. Retention is critical to maintain experienced staff and to increase efficiencies and productivity. The full-time FTE positions were requested at the annual base rate of $35.568. At the time of the LBR submission, the commission did not have the DMS $13 adjusted base rate of pay. The commission will be amending the LBR for 22-23 to reduce the number requested of full-time equivalent career commission investigators to 12 based upon the DMS $13 adjusted proposed salary rate. That concludes the presentation of our five priorities.
Well, thank you. Any questions? Seeing no questions, Representative Davis, you're recognized for question.
Thank you, Chair. One quick question. And I think what I heard is if you do not increase the salaries for your temporary commissioners to $200, then you'll be in violation. If you're not granted the funding here that you need, how do you solve that?
You're recognized.
Okay.
And so we start to make decisions. We'll all be as well informed as possible. Also, as a reminder, staff will be helpful to any questions or put you in touch with people that might be able to help and make you better informed. So that'll be it for today. Any further business? Seeing none, Representative Smith moves we rise without objection. We're adjourned.